The Country Hour with Sally Dacus.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Christmas Eve edition of The Country Hour. Well, let's begin with a quiz. What do these things have in common? Kimchi, sauerkraut, cheese and cider. Yes, we're talking bacteria. A group of food industry players are to put together a business case to establish Tasmania's expertise in fermented food, the not-for-profit Fermentation Tasmania.
The story is there's 10 times as many microorganisms in us than we have cells in our body. And there's a lot of evidence showing that fermented foods that actually you eat when they are fermented without any heat treatment, so you're getting all the good bugs, the good chemicals, that these are really, really good for your health as well.
We'll hear from food scientist Dr. Tom Lewis about the not-for-profit in the program today. And given that it is Christmas lunch tomorrow, we're going to preview some of the foods that people will be putting on their plate tomorrow. That's Rural News Time now.
Hello, I'm Kath McAlone. The federal government is considering extending a drought infrastructure funding program to two Victorian shires for the first time. The Drought Communities Program allocates up to $1.5 million to drought-affected shires to employ local people in upgrading infrastructure. Three additional Queensland shires became eligible for funding this week, and with only $5 million left to allocate, more than a dozen shires in Victoria and South Australia have been rallying for the remaining money. Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce says his government is assessing requests from Victoria's Bulloak and West Wimmera shires. West Wimmera Drought Coordinator Kelly Jordan says the need in her shire is clear.
I think you'll find that our shire has had a significant rainfall deficiency for at least 3 years, if not longer, two failed springs in a row. The impact of that, I mean, surely it's pretty obvious. We are in need of a boost to our economy, and this would be an ideal program to do that.
Farmers in southern Queensland are counting the cost of severe storms that rip through parts of the Granite Belt and Darling Downs overnight. Hail has ruined the entire crop at one of Queensland's biggest strawberry farms, and further inland there's been serious damage to sorghum and corn crops. And far north Queenslanders are bracing for a wet Christmas with the possibility of a cyclone in the Gulf of Carpentaria, and that's putting even more pressure on the region's mango growers to get their fruit to market. About a quarter of Australia's mangoes will be produced in the Mareeba-Dimboola region inland of Cairns in the next 6 to 8 weeks. But with rain clouds gathering, grower Joe Morrow says the pace is even more frenetic than usual, but the rain is generally welcome.
Oh, look, I think it'll be a positive. I think it'll help size up the fruit, and I think that we're going to get it over the break period, and I don't think it's going to be an awful lot of rain. I mean, yes, in other parts of Australia they might consider it a lot of rain, but it's just normal activity that we have up here. Mareeba's always dealt with the rain, and generally the quality still comes out A1.
The last live cattle export ship to load in Darwin for 2015 will leave for Indonesia later today, capping off a significant year for the industry. Export prices continue to hold at a record $3.50 a kilogram, with over 470,000 head shipped to various overseas markets from Darwin throughout the year. Patrick Underwood from the North Australian Cattle Company says the Galloway Express will soon set course for Indonesia with 4,100 head on board.
So these will be going into Jakarta. On the Galloway, it'll take about 4 days to get there, so they should arrive on the 28th off the vessel before the 31st of December, which is basically the rule with Indonesia. All your 2016 cattle have got to be in there by the end of the year.
100 mine workers in northwestern New South Wales have been stood down amid the closure of an antimony mine at Armidale. The world price of the metal, which is used in batteries and for fireproofing, has plummeted in the past year. Scott Jones of Hillgrove Mines says the mine will operate in care and maintenance mode until its future is decided next year.
Well, the antimony price over the last 12 months has dropped from slightly over $8,000 a tonne to under $5,000 a tonne. That's US. That has, you know, taken about 40% of our revenue. We're a long way from break even. We're actually losing significant money every month that we operate.
Tasmania's food and beverage industry plans to raise $150,000 for a scoping study on establishing a national centre of excellence in fermented foods. The not-for-profit Fermentation Tasmania has been established to drive research, training and development of products including beer, wine, cheese, cider and even fermented vegetables. Food scientist Dr. Tom Lewis says there's increasing research showing the value of fermented foods for human health.
There's a real opportunity here, I think, for Tasmania to do something special in the world. We're the only place that a regional development concept around fermentation exists in the world, as far as I can tell. A lot of other people look at sectors, but we've got a whole regional development, which is very exciting.
And an unlikely community initiative to help drought-affected farmers in northwest New South Wales and southwest Queensland has delivered its first payload. Drinks for Drought aims to bring Christmas cheer to families around Collarenabri, Durandabri, Mungindi, Walgett and Lightning Ridge. Organiser Cole Pring says donations of drinks and money have come from all over the country, with the first drinks delivered to Lightning Ridge.
And the comments were, we have a really hard day, we're cutting scrub to feed, and there's nothing more relaxing than going home and cracking a cold beer. It wasn't all alcohol, you know, there was a lot of soft drink, a lot of water. And I can tell you now that the people weren't too depressed when we turned up with a bit of Christmas spirit.
For today and this year, that's Rural News.
Thank you very much to Kath McAloon. Well, this is The Country Hour on ABC 936 and Northern Tasmania. It's 11 minutes past 12. In a moment, we're going to head to Canberra. Our political reporter, Anna Vito, has been looking back on some of the stories that have stood out throughout 2015, some of the big national stories, and surprise, surprise, some of them are ones that you might not have predicted would pop up on the radar. We'll have that story in about 6 or 7 minutes' time. And, of course, because it's Christmas, it is Christmas Eve, and we're talking food in the show today.
Originally, when they first done them in the 16th century, there was 20 different birds in there. So I'm not going to bone out anything smaller than a chicken.
This is a special story that James Euster, who's familiar to many in Tasmania, has tracked down. He's on the path of the, some say, mythical turducken. Intriguing. It was new to me, and hopefully new to you. We'll have that story between now and 1 o'clock. And also today, given that it is time for gingerbread houses, we'll have a story that might give you a little bit of an insight into the ginger industry in Tasmania. But now at 12 minutes past 12, as you heard in Rural News, a group of food scientists and industry players are putting together a business case to establish Tasmania's expertise in fermented foods. We're talking wine, cider, beer, cheese and lots more. Dr. Tom Lewis from rural consultancy RDS Partners is one of a foundation board of five, including the chair of Food Innovation Australia, Peter Schutz, who's looking to establish a group called Fermentation Tasmania. Now, Tom Lewis has been awarded an Agri-Food Skills Australia Fellowship to study overseas as a part of a scoping study for the initiative. And he says it has the potential to create expertise and will create opportunities on a regional scale.
We're calling this thing Fermentation Tasmania. The idea came from some work that came out of the university, the Centre for Food Innovation, a couple of years ago. And it was recognised that there's so much happening in Tasmania in the food industry, so many fantastic products, you know, your beers, wines, whiskies, ciders, that rely on fermentation. And it occurred to us that there's some really top talented people in Tasmania, world class, and also some small businesses that are crying out for skills and workforce.
So it's not just about promoting what we do and branding Tasmania as this centre of excellence in fermentation. It's building Tasmania's capacity?
Oh, very much, yeah. We see at the moment, we're doing our best not to presuppose what this is going to be, because we really want to go out and make sure that we ask the questions of industry and get what they want. But typically, and we've had good response about this, we see four arms for what we're doing. There's new product development, giving people the opportunity to play with new ideas and not necessarily in their own commercial environment, because sometimes they actually might want to play with a bug or a technique that just doesn't fit with what they're producing commercially. We need to do research. There is so much that we don't know about fermentation. And there's some great skills in Tasmania, research skills at the university, and we need to bolster that. We are looking at the skills and education for getting people into industry to help the sector grow. And also the last arm is around that consumer experience, you know, helping coordinate the idea of people coming down to Tasmania, maybe for 3 days, maybe for five, making beer one day, making cheese the next, and enjoying all the wonderful stuff in between, all the wonderful food in between.
So how are you funding this potential development? Because you do need funds to drive all this.
We do. Up until now, And you know, it's been just off our own back. We've just decided, look, it's something that's so much fun. You know, people say, oh, what drive, what energy? But it's fun, you know, and it's a really something that I'm really, really keen on. It's something that Kim Seagram is really keen on. We've got a board now. They're all really keen. So everyone's, you know, willing and happy to put their time in. But what we need to do now is our scoping study and business case. You know, we need to go around the world, see what's happening similar in different areas of the world, and then bring that back and really talk about it really closely with industry, with university, with government, with CSIRO, and to decide what we need to do. And once we do that, we have to do the business case, because we still don't know whether there is a solid business case for it or not, and we need funds to do that.
You're tuned to the Tasmanian Country Hour. We're having a conversation with Dr. Tom Lewis from RDS Partners. We're talking about Tasmania's potential becoming a centre of excellence in fermentation. In terms of the business case, you've mentioned your AgriSkills Australia Research Fellowship. Are you going to be able to do that as a part of that, or do you think that needs to be more than that?
It'll be more than that. The Agri-Food Skills Australia Fellowship that I've got will help fund my part of the scoping study. And for that, we're looking at two teams of two people heading overseas for 3 weeks per team. We wanted to do it one group, but there's just so much to see that we need to send more people overseas. So Agri-Food Skills Fellowship will fund me for that. And then once we come back, we need to then run the business case and actually bring the information back, talk to industry, talk to government, talk to CSIRO, talk to universities, saying, this is what we've learned, this is what other people are doing, what do we need to do here?
And the time frame for all of that?
Well, herding cats. We are hoping to actually get away on the scoping study in June this year. By the time we get the people who need to go all having the same opportunity to go, I think it's going to be June. But we still need to raise our money between now and then.
How much money?
We're looking at probably about $150,000. So it's not a lot. And we've got a number of people who are saying, yes, look, we're interested. But now's the time that we actually have to get serious about raising money, getting commitments, which is why we've actually incorporated. We're now a not-for-profit company. So there is, you know, a proper, strong, transparent governance. So when people start working with us, especially wanting to give us money, there is a legal entity there for them to work with.
What do you want to come out of it? You've mentioned three things. You've mentioned about training and upskilling, you've about underpinning the growth in the industry, and you've talked about potential inbound tourism. Is that it?
No, it's not it. There's obviously more. What I do for work, what I'm doing here, is about industry development in Tasmania. And you know, there's a real opportunity here for, I think, for Tasmania to do something special in the world. We're the only place that a regional development concept around fermentation exists in the world, as far as I can tell. A lot of other people look at sectors, but we've got a whole regional development, which is very exciting. And that, look, there's other things. There's value adding to, you know, what we're calling seconds in our horticultural produce at the moment, you know, the not so perfect stuff. There's a market for fermented foods, fermented vegetables, pickles. We know that we produce some of the best produce in the world. It may not look the best, but once we shred it up and ferment it and turn it into sauerkrauts or kimchi or whatever, again, another massive, potentially massive, I haven't even looked into it, but almost has to be a massive market for Tasmanian produce being turned into something that different countries want to eat.
But that ties in with a whole lot of new research into gut health, does it not?
The way I like to think of it is that, you know, we as a species, as a human species, evolved alongside food that fermented, because it's a natural process. You know, there is so much research about now that that gut health, that having the right bugs in our systems, is so good for our health. You know, the story is there's 10 times as many microorganisms in us than we have cells in our body. And there's a lot of evidence showing that fermented foods that actually you eat when they are fermented without any heat treatment, so you're getting all the good bugs, the good chemicals, that these are really, really good for your health as well. So, you know, I make all this stuff at home, Sally, because I just love it.
Dr. Tom Lewis is from rural consultancy RDS Partners on the not-for-profit Fermentation Tasmania, a foundation board of five, making some progress there. This is the Country Hour. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 12. We'll go to Canberra next.
The Tasmania Fire Service has declared tomorrow a day of total fire ban in Tasmania's southern fire region. All fires in the open are banned tomorrow. That means no burning off and no incinerators or campfires. Gas and electric barbecues are allowed. If a fire occurs in your area, report it to 000 and then listen to ABC Local Radio, your emergency broadcaster. For more information on total fire bans, call 1800 000 699 or visit the Tasmania Fire Service website.
What a year it's been for Australian agriculture. While a lot of the serious news is focused on trade negotiations this year, with some major deals struck and coming into effect, it was a couple of more bizarre stories involving a Prime Minister, a raw onion, and a couple of illegal American dogs that really stole the headlines. Our Parliament House reporter Anna Vito has been following the weird and the wonderful from Canberra this year, and she joins us now. Anna, welcome to the Tasmanian Country Hour program, a familiar program to you.
Indeed. Thank you, Sally. It is always an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Now, let's begin with a story about the onion because, of course, this has a special resonance to Tasmania, which is one of Australia's largest onion-producing states.
And indeed, home to the onion incident of 2015. Of course, Tasmania is where this happened. The then Prime Minister in March this year, when he was on a trip to Tasmania, was visiting an onion farm up in the northwest, I believe, and rather unexpectedly picked up and chewed into an onion, skin and all, which I think it's fair to say caused a bit of a stir, certainly here in Canberra, certainly around Australia and even internationally, was the subject of quite a bit of media reporting. And I mean, look, you know, there's obviously things that really resonate on social media, and certainly this was one of them this year. But what was interesting, I thought, was that Onions Australia, the industry group, really sensed an opportunity here. And its chief executive, Lichelle Earl, decided that she would come here to Canberra and present the Prime Minister at Parliament House with a variety of onion dishes. She had a chat to our reporter Danny Grinlay about how that went, and certainly it seemed like it was pretty successful, but maybe not in the way she was expecting.
I took him in 5 kilos of red and brown Aussie onions, and I also delivered a homemade sweet potato, feta and caramelised onion quiche, which he thought was delicious. It was amazing to wander into the PM's office and sit down with him. He took the opportunity to peel another onion, tell me how much it looked like the one he had in Tassie the other day, and then he took a few bites out of this one today.
You're kidding.
No, it was amazing. He said it was delicious and it was very healthy and very good for him.
So there you go. No one-hit wonder, the Prime Minister on the onion eating this year, Sally.
I wonder what that marketing was actually estimated to be worth for the Australian onion industry. And I have to say, the whole thing doesn't necessarily reflect all that well on the media, does it?
Or some have argued on the Prime Minister. Of course, hilariously, it sort of really spawned, you know, mountains and mountains of editorial and opinion writing about what this said about the Prime Minister's psyche, that he had done this with his onion. And look, I suppose we'll never really know, but I mean, fair enough. If the man likes a raw onion, he likes a raw onion.
Well, that wasn't, of course, the only incident when Australian politicians grabbed international attention. We picked a fight with Hollywood this year, of course.
We sure did. Let's revisit, shall we? One of the more bizarre moments of the year, courtesy of Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce.
Mr. Depp has to either take his dogs back to California or we're going to have to euthanise them. He's now got about 50 hours left to remove the dogs. There is a process if you want to bring animals in. You get the permits, they go into quarantine, and then you can have them. But if we start letting movie stars, even though they've been the sexiest man alive twice, to come into our nation, then why don't we just break the laws for everybody? So it's time that Pistol and Boo buggered off back to the United States.
That's Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce, of course, talking about Johnny Depp, the famous Hollywood actor, and his wife Amber Heard, and their two dogs, Pistol and Boo, who were not detected by quarantine officials when they landed in Brisbane, who were not declared to quarantine. And the minister saying, look, if the due process isn't followed, then what needs to happen is the animals need to be euthanised. Well, this caused an absolute, you know, sensation around Australia and internationally. Johnny Depp has, you know, given interviews where he said he might have to fight Barnaby Joyce if he's threatening his wife, all kinds of things. But in the end, the dogs, the two little terriers, were sent home to California safe and sound. But it was a very serious side to this too. The Department of Agriculture launched an internal investigation into how this was able to happen, how these dogs were basically allowed to be or able to be walked across the tarmac somehow and enter Australia, because we didn't even realise they were here until a dog groomer on the Gold Coast posted pictures to social media, you know, referring to these dogs. And importantly, there is also a court process that's still underway. Amber Heard has faced charges and through her lawyers is fighting for a trial to be held in early next year. So we'll have to watch this space and find out what happens there. Meanwhile, though, earlier this month, Barnaby Joyce was given an award by the Invasive Species Council for his handling of this incident. It's Principal Decision-Making Award, Sally.
Interesting, interesting. Well, more to play out in that story, of course, Anna. Of course, absolutely. It wasn't all lightheartedness this year, though, and certainly one of the big issues right through the year was trade, and that's still continuing too.
Absolutely. And a big deal for Tasmania and its horticultural produce in particular. First of all, we started the year with the entry into force of the Korean Free Trade Agreement and the trade agreement with Japan. And in Korea, we saw an immediate impact for cherries, something in the order of a 40% increase in cherry exports to Korea as the tariffs there were absolutely slashed. And certainly Tasmania really leading the way there. But it was also a very difficult start to the year for other sections of the horticulture industry, particularly table grapes and citrus, because Vietnam followed through on a threat to ban Australian fruit and vegetable imports over concerns around fruit fly. Now, that was eventually resolved mid-year, but it really underscored how fragile some of these markets and market access to some of these Southeast Asian countries does remain, particularly for horticulture producers. And they were really on the government to try and get something done about that this year, probably not with a huge amount of success, but it's been a continuing theme through the year. But it was a big deal for a big year for, you know, trade deal success too. Of course, most recently, we've seen the China Free Trade Agreement come into force and a second round of tariff cuts from China will kick in on New Year's Day for the very in-demand Australian infant milk formula, which of course has seen huge demand out of China this year. That'll mean that tariffs for Australian infant formula will be halved from New Year's Day. So good news there for dairy exporting states like Tasmania. And after a lot of up and downs this year, the massive Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-nation Pacific Rim trade deal, was finally sewn up in October. At one stage, it looked like it was all going to fall over altogether after years of negotiations because the US Congress was really starting to get bogged down and all their political kind of issues are really heating up with the presidential election there. But nonetheless, the whole thing came down to five marathon days of round-the-clock, literally round-the-clock talks in Atlanta, Georgia in the US. And during those talks, Australia and the US really went head to head over issues around medicines and intellectual property, but also about access to the United States for Australian sugar producers. And unfortunately, spoiler alert, we didn't really get much out of that. But it wasn't only Australia the US was fighting with. New Zealand, the world's largest dairy exporter, was fighting it out to the bitter end with the US to try and get the Americans and the Canadians to open their dairy markets to competition. And they didn't really succeed either, to be honest. But while the New Zealand Federated Farmers Chairman Andrew Hoggard supports the TPP overall, he, like the New Zealanders throughout this process, have had some of the best lines. And he did describe the Trans-Pacific Partnership as a bit of a medium-sized dead rat deal for Kiwi dairy farmers. Here he is.
We are never going to completely put out of business the entire US or Canadian dairy industry because we simply couldn't produce enough milk to create enough cheese for all the Americans' cheeseburgers. You know, I'm sort of hopeful over time enough consumers and taxpayers in all these other countries will look at their dairy farmers and go, well, hang on, how come the beef farmers and the arable farmers and the pork farmers can all handle the big wide world and yet you guys are still clutching to the apron strings and refusing to put on the big kitty pants.
That's Andrew Hoggett. He's from the New Zealand Federated Farmers.
The big kitty pants. That's an interesting phrase.
The big kitty pants. I think he's telling them to grow up, Sally. I don't know how much success he's going to have. And certainly Australian dairy farmers were a little bit miffed, I think, too, about the TPP. But look, there's still a long way to run on that one too. All 12 countries have got to ratify it through their parliaments. So look, we're probably not going to see any resolution there anytime soon either.
And Avito, it's been a pleasure to have you on the country and a pleasure to hear all your work out of Canberra. Have a great Christmas and no doubt you'll be churning out more stories in the new year.
I certainly hope so, Sally. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas, Tasmania.
There you go, Anna Vito, our political reporter in Canberra, putting things in perspective as she reviews some of the big stories or the more curious stories coming out of Canberra in 2015.
The Country Hour with Sally Dacus.
Thank you very much to Stan Murrow with the 12:30 news. In a moment, weather. And after that, the agri-political wish list for Tasmania's 2016 budget. We're going to hear from the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association and also tempting our taste buds, food and glorious food. Today, the ancient and somewhat mythical turducken.
Originally, when they first done them in the 16th century, there was 20 different birds in there. So I'm not going to bone out anything smaller than a chicken.
And we'll leave it at that until you hear that story from James Euster a little closer to 1 o'clock. Debbie Tabor at the Bureau of Meteorology. You have strange and wonderful things on the Tasmanian country, oh, do you not?
Which you certainly do, yeah.
You ever heard of a turducken? Have you ever heard of a turducken?
No, I haven't. And I thought you did well saying, what was that word, agri-political? I'm glad you got that one.
Once you've learned how to say rural reporter, fruit rural fly is good. The other challenging one. It's one of the things that go with the occupation. Yeah, exactly. And you'd have plenty in the Bureau of Meteorology, I'm certain.
Just meteorology is hard enough for people, I think.
I think spelling it is harder than saying it.
Yes. Yeah.
Where do those E's and the O's go?
Yes, anywhere.
All right. as we heard, a total fire ban for the south of Tasmania, but it's not just hot temperatures we've got to watch out for. We're talking winds. Do you want to just map out the synoptic, given no discussion of rain in the last 24 hours?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so no rain, as you said. We've got a high over the Tasman Sea, and that's extending a ridge over northern Tasmania. It's directing a warm northerly flow over the state and giving us this sunny day. But as you said, temperatures are warming up even more so for tomorrow. So it will be a warm night overnight tonight into Christmas Day, and the northerly winds will freshen into tomorrow, then strengthen further about the east coasts, and it will be a bit gusty over land. So a hot day in most places with temperatures of around 25 to 30 degrees expected about the northern and central areas, and then low to mid-30s in the southern half. So several places are very likely to see 35 degrees in the south and will be very close to Hobart's maximum temperature since 1945 of 34 degrees, going for 33. So if it gets to past 34.3, we will be setting a record. But a sunny and fine day throughout the state tomorrow, just the hot conditions and, as you said, a bit windy. So fire ban is in place and very high to severe fire dangers about the southern half of Tasmania, and very high for the central north and the Midlands. So apart from just some late showers on to the west coast tomorrow night, it'll be a fine tomorrow, but then it all changes for Boxing Day. As we've been suggesting, a very warm and humid night overnight into Saturday, and then a cold front crosses during the morning. So that will bring statewide rain, possible isolated thunderstorms, and that rain will ease to showers by the afternoon, then contract to the west, south and northeast in the evening. So we'll see a... Sorry?
You keep going.
A much cooler southwesterly change coming in during the morning, probably just after Santa leaves, I believe, on, that's Friday, isn't it? Yeah, but he won't be around Boxing Day. That'll be another place. Mm. But much cooler after, you know, coming into the west coast after midnight and then just creeping across the south and extending into the north and east, the cooler change sort of mid to late morning.
Fair to say that fruit growers are sort of hanging on your every word as you say that, Debbie.
Mm. Yes, well, fortunately, I guess the last week it has been quite consistent, the numerical models that we do interpret. So it's been, I guess, forecast well in advance, the hot day for Christmas Day, and it's progressively just crept up as the days have gone on. And, you know, as I said, likely to see the 35s. And then it is a good solid rain band moving across the state, and there hasn't been too much to-ing and fro-ing between the models with that. So we're really hoping that that works well with a good 10 to 20 millimetres across most places, a little bit less in the central north, probably only around 5 mils expected through there. And in the west, they may just get a little bit more than the 20 millimetres. So it does all ease back for Sunday, though, and we continue with a southwest stream and some showers about the west and south, and they will mostly clear by the evening, and also see some morning showers about the northeast, but fine elsewhere. And then on Monday, we're back to temperatures warming up and a fine day with light winds and afternoon sea breezes.
Coastal waters, then?
For the rest of today, north to northeast winds of 10 to 20 knots. They'll increase to 20 to 30 knots about the northwest and the east during this afternoon and evening, although remaining variable about the southwest below 15 knots. For tomorrow, north to northeast winds of 20 to 30 knots, though lighter about the central north and the southwest. And the winds will increase to 25 to 35 knots about the east in the afternoon and evening. And as I said, just becoming a little bit gusty over land. The wave rider is sitting on 1.8 metres at midday and a maximum of 2.5 with a period around 11 seconds. And the swells for the rest of today and tomorrow in the west and south, a southwest swell around 2 metres, increasing to 3 metres this evening and then persisting tomorrow. For the north, a westerly swell below 1 metre, and for the east, a southerly swell of 0.5 to 1.5 metres for both days, and also a northeasterly swell developing tomorrow morning at around 1 metre.
And any warnings?
Yes, we have wind warnings out. A strong wind warning today for southeastern waters from Wineglass Bay to southeast Cape, and also for northwestern waters from Sandy Cape to Stanley. And for tomorrow, a gale warning for southeastern waters from Wineglass Bay to southeast Cape for the northerly winds. A strong wind warning is current for all remaining coastal waters except the central north. And also for Storm Bay, although the central north is looking like very late tomorrow night, they might touch on the 30-knot mark. So also a small craft wind alert for the southwest and the central plateau lakes if you're boating.
And a final question on that rain band, Debbie, before you go. Is it going to hang around like during the day for a long period of time, or do you think it'll be quite a sudden downpour, like thunderstormy type thing, or it'll be extended?
It'll start from the west, in the west in the morning, and then just extend statewide during the morning. So I don't think it will be a sudden onset. It'll just be gradually progressing from the west, and then in the afternoon starts to tend to showers as the front sort of contracts to the northeastern parts and just lingers back there. So we'll still see some rain hanging around the northeast during the afternoon, and then some showers in the west and south. So hopefully it might improve for the late cricket game, something like that. But it is a southwesterly strain, so you'll get some breaks in between anyway.
Great. Thank you, Debbie. Have a great Christmas Day.
Thank you. You too.
Lovely. Debbie Tabor is talking to us from the Bureau of Meteorology, and the time now is 17 minutes to one, and this is the Tasmanian Country Hour. Well, Tasmanian farmers are calling on the Tasmanian government to do more for agriculture next year. The TFGA has tabled its 2016 budget submission and is calling on the state government to establish a new pool of funds for biosecurity. Chief Executive Peter Skillen says the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers supports the current biosecurity framework, but it's asking the government to set up a contingency fund for biosecurity incursions.
Our relationship with Biosecurity Tasmania is very good, and I've made the point several times this year that we will not comment on the internal workings of Biosecurity Tasmania. That's an issue between government and the respective unions. What we see on the ground, though, I must say, is excellent results and a compliment to the biosecurity staff. But we also need to recognise that biosecurity, as we move forward, is a very vital element in the agricultural sector. But arguably it's even more valuable than just the agricultural sector, and I think there's an argument to suggest that the broader community need to understand and come to appreciate the value of Biosecurity Tasmania. And I'll give you a perfect example. Fire ants currently are in Queensland, if they were to arrive in Tasmania, would do little or no damage in an agricultural sense. But in terms of living amenity for the broader community, they would play havoc. So biosecurity is not just about agriculture, it is about the whole community. Clearly there needs to be an education process around that.
Does that then mean more resources? Are you looking for more funding for this area in the 2016 state budget?
We've actually argued that, and we've put this in our submission, that government should put aside a contingency fund for biosecurity incursions. That is that Biosecurity Tasmania shouldn't be have to be in a position where they have to dig into their limited resources, their limited budget, to deal with an incursion. There should be a pool of funds available so that they can actually just go out there and dip into those funds to address the incursion. We've got to bear in mind that incursions at that point, when they first appear, that is the most economic viable time that you can deal with these. If they become established, then it becomes a much more expensive exercise. So in the long term, it's an investment for the future as much as anything else.
I was going to say it sounds a bit like a future fund, but what sort of quantum? Or would you leave that to government?
I think that's a conversation that we need to have. And, you know, there may be different ways of funding it, there may be different mechanisms to be used. So we need to sit down and have that conversation, and as I said, we put that in our submission.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your submission. What other opportunities do you see?
Well, the other one is coming up in 2016, not the least of which will be this particularly dry season that we're going to have to deal with in the first part of the year.
Yes, coming in here, I saw a brochure that was had basically named it up as drought. Most people have been talking about dry up till now, but is that what you're thinking too?
No, I'll continue to use the term dry season. We're still some distance away from that, but it is without question a very difficult year. And it's variable throughout the state. Some areas are still holding on reasonably well, while other areas are suffering quite dramatically.
Those areas that are holding on, though, are getting smaller and smaller, aren't they?
They definitely are getting smaller. I can speak from personal experience. It's starting to brown up in places that I haven't seen brown up on my place for a long, long time.
So then what do you actually think in terms of risk management at this stage?
For this season, I think it's about focusing on how we get through the season and trying to mitigate the effects of it as best we can, bearing in mind that many of the effects roll into the next season. They go through winter and into spring. Fodder in particular will be in short supply, and that's not going to be rectified until next season, on the basis that we actually have a decent autumn break and some decent spring rains in 2016.
Well, in fact, you've been putting up on a website a spot for people to communicate about their fodder needs and fodder supplies. What's the balance between supply and demand?
Well, at the moment, demand is much greater than supply, and that's an attribute of the season, no question about that. And, you know, in the early new year, in the first week of January or the second at the latest, we will have our fodder website up, which will allow people that do have fodder, who want to sell fodder, to put it up on the website, and those that are obviously seeking it will be able to go to our website and arrange to purchase their fodder through that process.
Why a mechanism like that rather than the general market, the open market?
Well, it's a centralised way of doing it and ensuring that we can maximise, supply versus demand, and ensure that those people who do want the fodder can get it as readily and as quickly as they possibly can.
Well, can we talk about prices, though? Because some people are saying just about anything goes.
Well, again, it's an issue of supply and demand. And when there's a greater demand than there is supply, inevitably the prices go up. And we're already seeing that at a relatively early stage in the season. I do not foresee at this stage it getting any better.
What have you heard at the moment?
Well, I've heard of prices of $15 a small square of grass hay. They're prices that I've not heard of for a long, long time. So I think that's indicative of where we're going.
CEO of the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association, Peter Skilling, was talking with Rose Grant, and the Tasmanian government funded the TFGA's feed and fodder register with a $44,000 grant. 11 to 1. Now the serious subject of Christmas food. Well, a festive feast is hardly complete without a gingerbread house. And in Queensland, a lot of effort goes into growing the spicy root that's the foundation of good gingerbread. Well, Callie Buchanan asked ginger grower Anthony Raybigan what makes good Christmas ginger.
If you put a little bit of love into it, a bit like when I grow watermelons and I sing to them, it's no different to growing ginger. Every day you've got to nurture and ensure that there's no stress in the, within the plant, and grow quality ginger. We do regular nutritional testing, water probes. So it's about nurturing the plant from planting right through to harvest.
Because ginger can be quite fragile, can't it? It's susceptible to disease.
It's extremely. It's I was going to say it's a bit like that olden day car or the best car that you've ever had, and you don't want to put a scratch on it, and next thing you know, you've got to nurture it. Ginger grows for a long period of time and takes a lot of skill and attention to detail to grow ginger.
But what's the payoff for you for putting in all that love and attention?
Well, I'm not just a farmer, I'm a food producer, and I actually enjoy eating the product, and that's where I think farmers sometimes forget about what they're doing. Whilst it is a business, you've actually got to enjoy the food that you produce. And I love the watermelons that I grow, and we eat a lot of them. And in particular now, we eat ginger every week, almost every day now. It's a fantastic food. It's great for our well-being and digestive, and enhances our digestive system. So it's a great food to have within the household.
One of my favourite uses of ginger, particularly at this time of year, is in the gingerbread house, which has become a bit of an icon around Christmas time, even though it's not cold in Queensland. Do you do a bit of gingerbread at home occasionally?
Oh, we make gingerbread men. My children love gingerbread men. They're a little bit spoilt in that we've got ginger muffins and ginger cake. And my daughter, Charlotte, loves cooking with ginger, and she's really good at it. And so we're probably, in our family, we're experimenting more than just the gingerbread house now.
So what do you use ginger in a typical Rabine Christmas feast?
Well, the Rabines generally love seafood, and there's nothing better than baked fish with ginger and some lemon. And lemon and ginger go hand in hand together. So baked fish for us on Christmas Day with ginger is the ultimate.
I've been lucky enough to sample some of your pickled ginger and your powdered ginger. It is incredible and difficult to describe, and I wish I could just highlight the difference between it and what I can buy on the shelf in a supermarket. Why is it so different, the stuff that you make?
When we do pickled ginger, it comes out of the field and goes into the bottle within 6 hours, and that's the trick. It's fresh and it's still alive. And it holds the quality, the eating quality of the product. The same with our ginger. We harvest the ginger at a particular time of the year, and we then grind it into a powder. So it's come out of the field, and within 36 hours, because drying takes a lot longer, but we retain the flavour. When you buy ginger powder in the supermarket, it's imported, it's been irradiated, it's old. Where's it from? There's a number of factors that change the eating quality of that powder. And if you were to put both of them together, there is a huge difference.
Ginger grower from Queensland, Anthony Rabine, was talking there with our reporter, Callie Buchanan, on the things that go into making ginger. We'll have news for you on the country in around 7 minutes' time. Well, another strange dish that started to take over Christmas lunch in Australia. It started to rival ham and turkey as the family favourite. But what exactly is it? James Euster hit the trail to find out more about the turducken.
For months I've been hearing rumours of a strange creature making its way across the country. Some people say it's as big as an ox. Others say it can fly. A man I met with strange eyes says it can have up to 4 beaks. What is this mythical creature I keep hearing of?
We've had another sighting here in Shepparton, mate. Third time this week.
Yeah, people around here are really nervous, Jim. They say it could come back as soon as Christmas Day.
At first I thought it was just a rumour, but then I saw it with my own eyes. It looks a lot like the Easter Bunny.
I knew I couldn't ignore the facts anymore. This isn't just another Christmas tale. This is the hunt for the turducken. Have you seen it?
No.
Do you know what the turducken is?
No.
What if I told you it's something like a chicken stuffed in a duck stuffed in a turkey? Have you heard of that?
No.
Does that sound like madness?
No.
Some of these cool characters were playing it too coy for my liking, but I knew I had to keep going. I'm looking for a thing called the turducken. Have you heard of it?
No.
Not at all.
Did you have an idea of what it could be?
Yes, you stick the chook inside the duck and then stick the duck inside the turkey and cook it all.
Is that a real thing? Is this mythical creature real?
I have no idea.
I'm on a bit of a mission.
Looking for Father Christmas.
No, not looking for him, but I am looking for something else. I'm looking for a thing called the tadukken. Have you heard of that before?
No.
Do you have an idea where I should start looking for something like that?
That lady over there.
Suspect number two, thanks very much.
Just when I thought I was going nowhere, I consulted with a close friend. Tim, I think I've hit a dead end with this tadukken. I just don't know what to do.
Mate, just go and see Ben the Butcher down the road. Look, I gotta go, bye.
Finally, I've arrived at the butcher shop. I'm nervous. I know I'm about to come face to face with the tadukken.
You must be here for the same reason I am. Looking for the tadukken?
No.
Alex's Meat Service in Port Pirie, just a local retail and wholesale butcher.
Now, I'm on the trail to find this mythical creature, the tadukken. Is it here?
It is. And
what does it look like?
Well, we got one there in the cabinet at the moment. It's not much of a shape to it because it is a boneless creature, so more of a blob than anything else.
Did you have to catch that one yourself?
No, I get them in like that and bone them out.
Can you tell us what this fella is? Can we go up and have a look at him and tell us what this fella here is?
Well, it starts with a chicken on the inside with seasoning, then a duck, and with also a different type of seasoning, and finish off with a turkey around the outside.
Now, I have heard you can also squeeze a pigeon or a squab into some sort of mix-up there as well.
Originally, when they first done them in the 16th century, there was 20 different birds in there. So I'm not going to bone out anything smaller than a chicken.
I'd be too scared to see what that thing would look like, but why is this so popular? How did it end up on the shelves here?
I had seen it, that they were doing them in Sydney, and thought I'd give them a go, and I thought I might sell 5, 6. This year we're up to 35. So it's pretty crazy. They are very, very nice.
So can you give us a description of how you would eat something like this?
Well, you need a lot of people around to start with, because it'll feed about 25 people. But we roast it up just nice and slow, glaze it up, and then, get stuck into it.
Is this a Christmas special, this tadukken?
Yeah, I only do them at Christmas time. I haven't got time any other time of year to do them.
So is this now a growing trend? Instead of the pork or something at Christmas, we're going to see more of these three bird species end up on the table?
Well, maybe. It's got a long way to go to overtake pork, though.
Righto, and the future for this bird, do you have a destination for it at this stage?
No, that's a spare one at the minute. I've got all the orders covered and I've got about 4 or 5 spare. But they'll go before next Thursday.
Well, I know a pretty hungry rural reporter that might have his eye on that one, so we might have to put him away.
Yeah, that won't be a problem.
I didn't learn much about this secretive creature, other than it can have more than 3 beaks and it is delicious. But wherever you are, make sure you keep a fork handy this Christmas.
That's Butcher Ben Ben Dunbar from Port Pirie in South Australia, ending that investigation by James Euster. Well, now to wrap up the show today, a Christmas-themed poem from our regular bush poet, Phil Rush.
Well, it's nearly Christmas. So this is just Carols by Candlelight, and I know a lot of you will understand this poem, hopefully. We've come to the park, and we've gathered together to celebrate Christmas in spite of the weather. We've come for our families, our friends and relations who want to join us in our celebrations, along with our neighbours who are here in their dozens, and so are their nieces and nephews and cousins. There's a murmur of voices, of laughter and chatter, as friends reunited enjoy a good natter. And then there's the carols, with all of us singing, including the youngsters, their high voices ringing like bells in a steeple, announcing with joy the birth of a saviour, a wee baby boy, who we sing how the angels proclaim at his birth. Goodwill among men and peace upon earth, glory to God in the highest and more. We sing of the wise men who came to adore, along with the shepherds at Christ in the stable. We sing of this babe as the one who is able to save all mankind from the wages of sin, as we open our hearts and we let Jesus in. As we sit on the seats in our warmest apparel, we all sing with gusto the words of each carol. and see all the small children look around in delight at the flickering candles, a marvellous sight. And as babies start yawning and on parents nestle, we have to agree that Christmas is special. A time of rejoicing, a time of thanksgiving, a time of reunions, a time for forgiving. A time to be friendly, a time we are aware that others may need both our love and our care. A time to help people in various ways, but Christmas is only a matter of days. Problems and sicknesses, trouble and strife don't just affect people at Christmas in life. They can come any time from New Year to December, but the spirit of Christmas we don't all remember if trouble strikes people in some sort of way in March or July or October or May. We don't always act in the way that we should. We don't find the time to help out if we could. We all know that Christmas is a time of good cheer. So let's make a Christmas for the whole of next year. And all, happy Christmas to you all. See you next week.
And thank you to Phil Rush, and best wishes to Christmas from all of the ABC Rural team. And the Country Hour will return on the radio next week after the Boxing Day Test cricket. Cheerio for now. It's 1 o'clock now.